So cool. Any questions before we get started? I did get a question. Are there any books? And a gentleman asked, he said, John, have you written a book or is all of this just in your head? Which I thought was kind of a cool phrase. I have written a book. It was written for Visual Studio 2005, and it was called Debugging .NET 2.0 Applications. That book hasn't been updated, primarily because Wintellect has grown to the point where I can't disappear for 6 months anymore. So we're still trying to figure out, you know, do I get a co-author? What are we going to do with it? It's just, I apologize, but, you know, with a number of folks we have, I kind of owe them first crack at my time these days. So there is another book out there. It's not on Visual Studio. It's by a friend of mine, Mario Hewart, and the book is Advanced .NET Debugging. It is nothing but Wikibug and SOS. It is very hardcore, and it is very, very good. So if you're doing that kind of work, how to get mini dumps, all of that, you know, Mario's got you covered. But, you know, other than a few blogs between, you know, like my blog, Jim Griesmuth's blog, not a whole lot of folks talk about, you know, the debuggers much anymore, right? You know, everybody else talks about Silverlight. So I'm going to get creamed by Microsoft here one of these days. Yeah.
Quick question. I think I looked at this myself. You mentioned automated testing earlier, like ending it, those kind of tools. A little bit dismissive. Do you have to
use
those tools yourself?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what I was being dismissive about was people that spend 3 weeks trying to automate something that they could do in a half hour manually.
Right.
You know, but no, I use those. Oh, absolutely. Oh, I love MS Test. I do everything I can. And what's the big thing with testing as far as Dev 10 goes? The coded UI test. Right? You can record and play back any UI now. So, you know, Dev 10 really brings, you know, completes the circle, right? We had, you know, basic library testing before. The web testing is quite good, right? And those of you that have done the web testing, right, you know, it's pretty awesome. But they brought the final piece of it in, which is full UI testing through automation model. So I use that extensively. And we've had very, very good luck with that stuff at Wintellect. We've, you know, really used it. I didn't mean I just see folks that go nuts. You know, let's spend 3 weeks automating something that we could do a half hour once a week. It's just like, come on, you know, the client's not going to pay for that. You know, let's knock that off. So that's what I argue against. Folks try to take it. You know, sometimes just sitting down and spending a half hour doing it manually is going to get you more bang for the buck. Right? Don't be afraid to do manual stuff. In certain scenarios. Don't be afraid to use the debugger. So didn't mean to imply that they were bad, because I use them constantly. So cool, great questions. Any other questions? Okay. Well, good. Last hour of the session here. Let's get going. We were starting to talk about the .NET reference source code, and I said that, you know, somewhere up at the high of the chain, somebody realized that Microsoft, wow, with Reflector, you kind of have the source code. Okay. So what they released was this thing called the .NET reference source code, and the idea was when you go step into, you know, the ASP.NET page, the right source code shows up. And, you know, this is pretty cool. Got some caveats with it. First off, you have to turn off just my code and enable source server support in the options dialog. Then you have to set up the your options dialog for the debugger, set your symbol locations, and set it up for the reference source code. Or you can do the easy thing. Just use my PowerShell script. How do you think I set up my machines? I'm not going to do this manually. Right? So I wrote a PowerShell script to automate it. I love my PowerShell. Right? PowerShell is awesome. How many of you have used PowerShell and given up? Right? How many of you used PowerShell? Okay. Cool. For those of you that haven't, you took one look at it and went, God, what the hell is this?
How many of you looked at it and, you know, yeah.
I'll just warn you now, PowerShell doesn't have a steep learning curve. It has a negative learning curve, okay? But it, seriously, get into it. It's pretty awesome stuff. It's the future. So anyway, I wrote a bunch of scripts. You can look for them in the scripts directory. There's other scripts in there that set registry keys for Visual Studio and whatnot, but that'll set up your machine. For you guys, you're going to do a set VS 2010 symbols dash public. That will set your machine up. Go look at the script. It's, by the way, it's all digitally signed and everything, so it's all cool. But that will set your machine up for this .NET reference source code. But I got to be honest, .NET reference source code, lots of problems with it. For whatever reason, I can't figure out who owns this at Microsoft, but the instant they release a hotfix, that's the version of the source code they put up. So if you don't have the absolute latest and greatest of every single DLL on your system, the .NET reference source code won't work for you. And there's no real errors telling you what you got and what you don't have.
So, you know, you have to have a fully up-to-date, fully patched machine. Sometimes you run into problems where Microsoft has released a hotfix, but they haven't put it in Windows Update. Guess what? You still won't get the source code because they're pushing out the latest and greatest. And people have complained a lot about this, but I don't know where it stands inside Microsoft, but the idea is let's just use the do what we can with this. So the big problem is that you only can debug a single file at a time. And the idea is, well, I just want to go grab all of the stuff at once. So a gentleman from Turkey, Karim Kuzmezer, and myself, we got motivated one day, whipped out an open source project. You can get up a CodePlex called NetMask Downloader. And, you know, I'll just mention it to you. I'm just about to pull this project off the CodePlex because I am sick and darn tired of answering the same question over and over. Doesn't work for me. If you got the source code, you know, help us out, you know, for the love of God, you know. And I just get emails all the time. I tried it. It didn't work. You suck. You know, I'm like, no. You know, we give you the source code. You know, we went through the hassle with Microsoft to get permission to put this out. So, you know, it always comes out that you don't have the latest version of whatever it is Microsoft has at this up on their .NET reference symbol server. So, you know, this thing is kind of become, honestly, I think in many cases more of a pain in the butt than anything else. However, it is pretty cool to kind of see, you know, if you're dealing with a page, exactly how it works, for example. So there is some coolness to it. But I got to admit, you know what I use these days? I don't use this. I use .NET Reflector Pro. Isn't it about .NET Reflector Pro? It's awesome. Redgate took over .NET Reflector, and they have this Pro version. And it needs an update for .NET 4.0, so I can't show it to you. But what it allows you to do is that you right-click on the assembly, and you say decompile it. It decompiles it, builds the PDB, and then you can single-step exactly the exact binary you're dealing with on your machine. Yeah, so don't tell managers. Right? You know, it's bad enough when managers find out about Reflector, but when they find out that people can debug into your stuff, you know, and, you know, they'll die. But, I've honestly found, you know, the money was well worth it. Just get .NET Reflector Pro. End of story, right? It's done. So, you know, it is available. I think they were going to post the .NET code, the .NET 4 code, yesterday. Okay. Since I was traveling yesterday, didn't really get a chance to check. So, NetMask Downloader should work if you run it against your, .NET 4 directories and let that rip. So, you know, it's just, it's there. And if you get it to work, great. If not, debug through it. You know, it's generally some problem that you have no control over. Okay, but it is there. So let's talk about exceptions. All right, let's get back to some thought process here. Let's think about exceptions for a minute. Let's draw the timeline of your application. Your app is running along, and then boom. I don't know if you know what exceptions look like, but that's what they look like. Okay. So your app, you know, the big thing here, this is root cause. Okay, this is the holy grail of debugging. There's your root cause. What's the mistake people make? They continue to execute. And then what happens? Well, death. Okay? And it is sad. Okay? It threw flowers around the grave. Okay? But here's the problem, right? People keep running. And you now have a gap between root cause and death. How big is that gap? Could be 2 milliseconds, could be 2 weeks, right? But the instant you have a gap between root cause and death, you are so totally hosed, it's not funny. Because you now can't, you know, to isolate root cause is nearly impossible, okay? So what you want to do is you want to stop this. Stop doing this, folks. You want to die here. Finish our P. If I knew how to draw sad people, you know, draw sad faces, you know, there we go, okay? But, you know, you want, actually, no, this is happy faces because you can debug the app, okay? So this is happy faces. Okay, there, you're all happy. You can debug the app because you have a one-to-one mapping between root cause and death. Write your app assuming it can crash. This means you're going to have to architect things where you do effort to save state and other things, okay? And years ago, I used to show this demo. It was great. It was an old version of Word. And I'd pull up this
giant Word docs, like 62 pages. I go to page 30, go like three paragraphs in, and just the right spot, I would type a W. And you know what happened to every character in that Word doc? Turned into a square. Right? The document was corrupt, but in the olden days, right, you know, when I was a young man and had no gray hair, we wrote apps assuming that, yeah, let's let it run forever. No, you can't crash. You got, you guys remember stories from, years ago where, I've been working on my PhD thesis, been backing it up regularly, and you've had a corrupt document for the last 2 months. Yeah, stuff like this happened all the time. So the Office team did a huge effort. Right, and rewrote big chunks of Office and save state, do other things, right? Have you ever noticed the hidden file next to your Word, your docx file? That's got the undo state and everything else in it so they can rebuild that doc after you crash. So, I got to give the Office team a huge amount of credit. When was the last time you lost anything in an Office application?
Jeez, I can't remember. I think I lost a sentence in 2002.
Right? It's pretty incredible. But they wrote these apps assuming they could go down at any given time. Right? And you need to do the same thing. You need to write your apps, taking advantage of restart managers that we have now in the OS, so on and so forth. In fact, there was a book out called Solid Code by John Bruno and Donis Marshall. It's a very, very good book. Talks a lot about how Microsoft develops software. John Bruno's a GPM on Live. He's been at Microsoft for many years. Donis Marshall is a developer. He's done a lot of work for us at Wintelet. And it's a very, very good book. Talks about, and one of the stories they tell is how the Messenger team wrote the original server apps for Messenger years ago before we had restart managers and, all of this good stuff we have today. They had all these services that monitored their main service, and if it crashed, they'd immediately restart, all of this stuff. And, when was the last time you lost anything? Who had our communicator? Never, right? That it's a very, very robust app, okay? And, but the book is Solid Code.
It's a very good book to take. It's a very, very good book for your manager. If you're reporting through a chain that has some non-technical management, this is a great book. Because the number one question I get when I go into a company, I generally have to deal with some senior manager because they're like, hey, who is this expensive guy we're paying for?
I have to go talk to him for a little bit, and their number one question these senior managers all ask me, how does Microsoft develop software? And now I just basically hand them this book. So it's a very good book for non-technical managers. It does do some technical stuff, but it talks about the thought process of great software. Also, what's also very interesting about the book is the developer that wrote the foreword to the book is the best-looking developer in the business.
Yeah. I want you to think about that one. That one went over everybody's head. But, think about it.
Never mind. Let's get back to this.
So I want to say one more thing about this, okay?
I've done my fair share of security work, right? Security hacking, all this kind of stuff. This gap here,
this is what we look for,
okay? This is what security guys and the bad guys, more importantly, live for. Because if we can get your app running in an unstable state, we rub our hands with glee. We pwn you now, sucker, right?
That's exactly what we think. So I want you to think about two scenarios.
Scenario number one. Well, the main scenario is, or two options to this scenario.
The scenario is your app crashes. Your server app crashes.
Option number one. Hey, boss. Yeah, the app crashed. We restarted it. If the app crashes, end user's going to have to press F5. Refresh the page. Okay? Option number one.
Option number two. Yeah, boss. We don't know what happened. We lost 250,000 customer records with credit card numbers, date of birth, social security numbers, and mother's maiden names.
Which would you rather explain to your boss? I think option number one.
This is a massive security hole. This is a big enough security hole to drive a truck through. Okay? Because if anybody can get your app running in an unstable state, you're pretty much hacked. Okay? Let the app crash.
Now, you're going to have to architect for this, you're going to have to build for this, you're going to have to, think about how do we save state, because if you're trying to keep the app running, you're so totally screwed for solving the problem. In fact, a couple years ago, we did some work at a company, won't mention their name because you know who they are. They called us up and they said, hey, John, we want something like Watson. right? Because Microsoft has this thing when you crash, right, it sends the crash dump up, you know, totally awesome system. And I'm like, well, you just go to winqual.microsoft.com and they will give you all the mini dumps and all the crash reports. Oh, we don't trust Microsoft. They're going to look at our stuff. I'm like, no, they're not. You know, just you know, it's going to cost you $500. You're like, and they're like, we want you to build Watson for us. And I'm like, that's crazy. They said, here's the money. Okay.
We're not stupid, you know. I mean, you know, we try to help the customers out, but we'll take their money, you know. We ended up building, and they ended up working with us, and we built basically Watson, the same thing Microsoft had. And this was an app with a bunch of native components with it. It's been around for a long time. Many of you use it. And
we noticed an interesting phenomenon. During the beta, turned on this Watson, did the work to let the app crash. You know what we found out? Two lines of code responsible for 60% of the crashes. Okay?
Let the app crash. You can then debug the thing.
Okay? That's the moral here. That's what I want to get through to everyone. Right? Because if you don't let the app crash, you're going to see this smiling face coming in to debug your app at some point, right? Because almost all the bugs we work on, that's the situation. How do we figure out what this root cause is, right? And so, you know, just trying to save you some time.
But the good news, Visual Studio has very good support for debugging exceptions, okay?
So let's go take a look at this. So come here, mouse. So let's take a look at this. And we'll open up another project. I hope. There we go.
And open up a good old throwy catchy here.
And I love that, right? This is RTM too, right? They lose focus, they go to the background, they come back. You know, it's kind of like the 3D zoom or something, you know? Anyway, so let me set this up. I mean, everybody close their eyes. Let me make sure my system is set, because I think I screwed something up. You got to love it.
Okay, so I'm going to run this app under the debugger, and this app throws and catches exceptions.
Oh, by the way, how many of you have had this really cool bug?
You have a throw here. You expect this catch block to be invoked, but it never gets called because somebody in the middle ate the catch.
Right? How many of you, you know, it's like, what the hell? So you want to know your exception handling and follow
anytime you have an
exception through to see who's touching it, what finally blocks are being called, and so on. So, you know, you want to be very cognizant of what's going on here, right? So this app just throws and catches, okay? Nothing too exciting. But the big thing here is this debug exceptions dialog. You've got a lot of control. So you want to figure out, you know, you've got all the common language runtime exceptions. You can add your own to this dialog.
And, you know, you can go down here and you can set this to, hey, whenever an argument exception is thrown, stop.
Okay? And so you can get notified when it's thrown. By the way, how many of you run your app under the debugger and you see a whole bunch of first chance exceptions written out? How many of you, right? That's bad. Okay? You know, what you've got, you know what first chance is? That's a debugger term. And debugger guys, we made up that term for job security. Okay?
What that means is that you've had a throw and somebody's caught it. That's what a first chance exception is.
Second chance exception, that's the debugger term for you crashed. Okay? So first chance exception, somebody threw and caught it and handled it. So that's a handled exception. Okay? So, you know, exceptions are not evil. Okay? Gratuitous exceptions are evil. Don't do like one client, they had this performance problem, they called us in and said, you know, hey, can you look at it? And man, I'm looking at this code and I'm going, what the hell are they doing? And I'm seeing code like this that looks like, you know, try, and they do some check, and at the very bottom, they literally had throw.
And they were wondering why they had a performance problem, okay?
And it's just kind of like, you know, when you throw an exception to return a good value, yeah, that's going to suck, okay? You know, they spent about a third of their time, it was crazy, you know, but, you know, Jeffrey Richter's probably going to kill me, but, you know, gratuitous exceptions, right?
What are those? That's just way too many.
So that depends on the app, depends on what you're doing, but you know it. It's kind of like how the Supreme Court defines pornography. I know it when I see it. Same thing with gratuitous exceptions, okay?
You know it when you, hey, wait a minute, we should be throwing this man. Okay? You know when you're looking at the app.
So you want to be able to debug your exceptions. So we've got this great little support here in the IDE where we can set for individual exceptions, but more importantly, what I like to do pretty much every other day is turn all of them on. I want to know anywhere that's having a throw. So I'll run this app now, and we'll take a look and watch what happens. Boom, we have the invalid cast. There's where it occurred. So this is where it was thrown, and there's the exception information, all of that. That's pretty cool. You know, there's our dollar exception, by the way, it shows up there. That's kind of cool. So we can see that. Now, here's the cool thing. We want to see where any finally blocks, any catch blocks that are going to be invoked as part of this. So what am I going to do? I'm just going to press F10 and walk my exception handling chain and see exactly who's looking at this. Okay, because you want, you know, this is where your app is, something's a little different. This stuff doesn't get tested that much. This is probably where you're going to have that really nasty problem. Okay, so get used to this every other day. Just turn it all on, run your debugger. You know, just everybody on the team needs to do this, test and dev, right? Where are the exceptions in my application? Okay, let's talk about another thing here. Speaking of exceptions, let's talk about an
stupid PowerPoint. There we go. Don't get me started on PowerPoint breaking the tablet PC. Okay, you've all written code like this. Let's think about this. So up here in the try, you have one of those nasty exceptions. That means it finally gets executed, right? It finally always gets executed. What happens if O is null?
Throw
in another exception. What happened to the original exception? Poof! It just disappeared. Okay? Man, your life just became a living hell. Okay? Because, you know, if you've got this situation right here, you masked off the original exception. Because this null reference exception is going to take precedence, and all you'll know is you have the null reference exception, not where you got there. So when you're doing a code review, there better be above it if O not equal null, okay, at least check that you can safely call that method.
That way there's no surprise. That's just part of your code review, right? We worked with a bank in the UK.
They had, you know, hundreds of .NET developers. This was their problem. And they were like, hey, what can we do to fix this? And I'm like, well, fix the code. They said, well, because of the way our QA process is, it's going to be about an 8 to 12 week cycle. Right? Just the way they had, you know, just typical, you know, IT in a bank, you know, 5 million people had to be involved with every code change. And they said, is there anything we can do to short circuit that? And I'm looking at them like, you guys are nuts. I said, well, we could write a profiler and instrument the code on the fly and stick in try catch finallys and log wherever you are through a profiling API by rewriting the IL. And they go, we might get that through faster than fixing the code. They're like, okay, that's it. We're not doing it.
I'm doing it away, you know?
But we eventually got the fix.
I'm sitting here going, these guys are just insane, you know? I mean, they literally thought we can deploy that faster than we can to fix the code.
It was like, run away, because
I could just see me taking down one of those production boxes at the bank, you know? So, you know,
be cognizant, right? Debug your exception handling. How many of you do a SharePoint?
If you do a SharePoint web ports? Okay, a few of you? Right. Those folks doing SharePoint are just kind of doing that. you never see SharePoint guys going, I'm doing it, you know?
SharePoint's cool, man. It's the fastest billion-dollar business Microsoft has ever had. You know, it went from zero to $1 billion in like 18 months. I mean, that's mind-boggling, you know, how big it is. So SharePoint, though. Let's talk about these exceptions in SharePoint. Just thinking the word SharePoint throws an exception. Those of you debugging SharePoint know what I'm talking about, right? SharePoint throws exceptions all the time. So let me mention one thing. Remember I had you guys turn off the
just my code? Well, if you're doing SharePoint or you're doing stuff you don't control that's throwing like mad and you don't have control over it,
I realize, you know, not everything can be perfect. What you're going to do is go into debug options and, believe it or not, turn on just my code. Now you will only stop on those exceptions where you actually have
source code.
So that way you're not stopping, you know, every time SharePoint decides to, you know, do an instruction. Okay? And so this way, you know, this is, and the good news here is you can toggle off and on just my code.
Okay.
But generally, you want to run with it off. But if you're dealing with this exception situation, you know, and stopping wherever there's a throw, this is where you want to toggle it on. Okay. So I just thought I'd mention that because it's just kind of, kind of bizarre. One last totally bizarre thing I'll mention about exception handling. So let me do that in valid cast again. There we are. We stop. So, in fact, let me do it someplace else. Let me do it on the null. And let's do a null reference, okay?
Oh, heavy sigh. We got a null reference.
Okay. Have you ever seen one of these before?
but, you know, there we've got our null reference. You know, sad, sad day, right? SB is null. However, sometimes just during general development, especially when you're building the code, you're working on the code, it's like, oh, shoot, I just forgot to initialize that.
Right? You know, you could stop the code, you know, fix it and everything. Sometimes you, let me just get through this one thought process, right? Log a bug, remind yourself to do it. But this is the only time this will be available. You have to stop on the first chance exception, and in the call stack window, you right click, and for the first time and only time ever, you will see unwind of this frame enabled.
Okay?
What this does, resets the instruction pointer to the before the instruction that caused the exception. Okay? So now if I press F10, what's going to happen? Well, no reference exception. But it's like, okay, fine, I unwound back. What can I do here? Well, that's no. Let me fix that. All right, so there I fixed it. Now press F10 and cause the exception. Okay? So that's the only time you have to stop when it's thrown.
And then the only place this shows up is at the very top of the stack, right-click, unwind to this frame. That'll just boop,
unwind you so you can re-execute that instruction, kind of keep yourself going. And so, you know, especially when you're playing around, hey, what if I do this, what if I do that? You know, oops, forgot to initialize that. That's how you can initialize it. Okay? So just keep that in mind. It's just a little cool little trick there. Okay? So I think we talked about the exceptions. Okay, you can add your own. Okay, it's pretty cool, right? Add your own types. By the way, the exceptions are stored in the .suo file. Woohoo! So, it's kind of a problem. So, if you want to write macros to add exceptions, well, I wrote macros to do that for you already. Go look at my macros, because I do this all the time. I show you some generic
macros that wrap up all the problems of adding exceptions. Then you can just chain to my macros. And you just basically just specify the type as a string. That'll automatically add it to the dialog.
And so if you're doing this constantly, it makes it kind of easy. Okay? So add your own, pretty easy. Okay? So we kind of mentioned this already. One thing that Visual Studio has for us is the ability to look at dumps.
And here is thank God this finally showed up.
This is a phenomenal debugging trick. Remember, this does require you go to .NET 4.0. Okay? You can't use .NET 2.0. You got it? Got to go to 4.0 to get this. But this opens up a phenomenal debugging trick. We've all done this, right? Where you're debugging through, oh, yeah, I got the bug. Excellent. Then the very next time you debug it, you can never get it again, right? It's very, very frustrating. So especially if you think that you're getting somewhere with the bug, what you want to do is get in the habit of doing the following, because this is available. This is a full .NET 4 app. Anytime you want to, debug, save dump as.
So with .NET 4, you can save the dump off, and this will save the dump.
Now, you have two types of dumps. Only one matters. You need mini dump with heap. This is a photograph of the address space. There's really two types of dumps in Windows.
Watson dumps, right, when you crash and they send something to Windows, to Microsoft,
that is a Watson dump. That literally has just enough information to talk to native stack, zero .NET, so you can't work with those. You need the full memory dumps. And you can think of these kind of like photographs, right? Because that's what these are, photographs of your address space. The mini dump, that's kind of like your cell phone picture. And a mini dump with heap, that's where you got the big DSLR and, you know, megapixels, right?
You know, it's just
resolution, what you can see. But for .NET, you need to see the mini dump with heap to see everything. So, so we'll save that. Totally cool.
And, sometimes these take a while to write. My poor little hard disk is driving away. But, you know, it's done because I have the ultimate tool for my machine, an SSD. Right? SSDs rock. Memory hard drives are the way to go. Never buy platters again. Okay? And I got to brag about my Lenovo. Okay? Can I brag about my Lenovo
for a second? So I go to the Lenovo site. My existing machine's blue screen. So I'm like, oh, man, this sucks. So I go to Lenovo site, and of course I do what everybody does. I max out the machine. My 4 gigs of RAM,
best of everything, right? you know, top of the line tablet PC.
And I'm looking at the price going, that's not right. That price is way too low. So I look at all the different options.
And I realize not only is Lenovo going to give me the SSD for free,
they're going to pay me to take it.
So I like, okay, I've got this maxed out tablet PC, top of the line, everything in it. It's $1,800.
So I, being a smart guy, said bye.
So this is like 11 o'clock at night. I call Lenovo.
Over the next day, I said, hey, okay, what's the real price of this machine? Because I got to get it through my boss, and he's going to kill me. And, you know, Daddy Rabbit. That's who we call Lewis, our CEO, right? And you don't want to mess with Lewis and money. He will kill you.
You know, and it's brutal. So I'm calling Lenovo going, okay, how much got charged to the company credit card, right?
Because, man, if this is over the limit, Lewis is going to just beat me to death.
So I call him up. I'm like, okay, how much was this
computer really? Because I looked on the website. They fixed it the next morning. It's $3,300. And I'm like, oh, man, okay, so I got to cancel this order. So I call him up, and I say, hey, I ordered this machine last night. The price was obviously wrong. And I said, you know, what do I got to do to cancel? And the guy, whoa. Mr. Robbins, that bug was in our website. We're going to honor the price. And I'm like, you're kidding me. He goes, oh, wow, look at that. I'm like, what? He goes, you have a faster CPU than we normally put in the machine. We're going to honor that as well. But our website was really screwed up. Yeah, there's the email. Nope, you ordered. We're going to honor it completely. And I'm like, you're kidding me. When am I going to get this machine, right? Is it going to be like 6 months from now? He goes, click, click, click. You'll have it in 14 days. And so they completely honored this $3,300 machine for $1,800. Buy Lenovo. Buy Lenovo. Okay?
Here, I did my job for Lenovo.
So, you know, it was incredible. So I told all my friends about it. My friend goes up to the Lenovo website. He does the same math out. They now have a bug in the CPU. If you click the highest performance CPU, it's now $999,999. My friend was livid. He wanted to kill me. And, you know, it was Kenny Kerr, who's a fellow columnist at MSDN Magazine. He blogged about it. He said, I'm just gonna kill that Robbins guy. I just can't believe it.
And he's got the screenshot where he shows the before and after checking the high-speed CPU. He was smart enough not to say bye. Because if they're going to honor the low price, they probably honor the high price. So, you know, but buy Lenovo. But anyway, I got an SSD in this machine, which is just the greatest thing ever, right? It's the one thing you can do to speed stuff up, especially dump writing, right? This is just that tiny little stupid app with a couple of buttons on it. How big is this dump?
Hey, nothing like 145 megs amongst friends, okay?
So that literally, that's everything in the address space written to disk. So here is a hint.
If you're doing production dumps, what you want to do is get an SSD and an enclosure and write your dumps to that SSD.
Because if you're trying to write them on the machine that it's operating on the hard drive where the OS is running, literally production dumps can take 5 to 10 minutes. And how much work is getting done when a dump's being taken? Nothing. All the connections are coming in and falling off on the floor, right?
Waiting for the janitor to come in and sweep them up. So what you want to do, get that SSD drive, right? That it's expensive. Get the Intel. That's the fastest one out there. And, you know, you can literally get your dumps in a fraction of the time.
You know, I've seen, like, before and after, you know, on these production boxes where, you know, literally it's taking 10 minutes. We're taking the time down to 3 minutes. Okay? And when your production servers block, you know, this is what you got to do.
Now, if you've got load balancing, network load balancing, that's the ultimate, right? Because you've got a backup server, you can redirect everything. The backup server life is good.
But how many of you have that? Not very few, right? That takes some pretty, you know, that takes beefy money and a bunch of hardware to do. So the cheap thing, get an SSD drive, put it in a box, USB.
Man, you'll get those dumps way faster than trying to do it off the current machine. So, you know, these dumps are huge.
I've seen dumps coming off 64-bit servers, 6 gigs.
Easy.
6 gigs. A little tough to email. Okay? So, you know, just be prepared. Practice with this stuff. See what it is on your stress test. Get an idea for this size. All right? Because these dumps are gigantic.
So we've got the dump there, right? You know, pretty cool.
How do we take a look at it?
File. Open. File. C/junk.
Okay, there is my dump.
Open it up. Okay. This loads the dump. Now, here's the totally awesome thing about dumps and .NET, right? Because if you've ever looked at this stuff with SOS, it's painful. They built a full-blown IO interpreter that when you load up this dump, they essentially execute the IO for the function, then go figure out what the values are for everything. Okay? So it's very, very cool. So it by default, it's on. You can choose mixed, native only. I'll do mixed. Now, this is a full 64-bit happening dump. This will run through. This is loading symbols, loading it up,
and hitting the network.
Poor machine and live meeting and everything. So that's exactly where we took the dump. There are all my threads. Okay. Just like I was there. Okay?
So this is great. This is a big feature, DevPen. Makes your life massively easier. Okay?
The dump that you take from Task Manager, is that similar
to that? The dump you take from Task Manager, absolutely. That is a full memory mini dump. Okay? So that works perfect for .NET. Any dump, when you pull up Task Manager and go to Processes, right click and say Create Dump, that's going to give you the full memory mini dump. Okay?
What's that? You need .NET 4. Yeah, you've got to make the commitment. But you guys are all going to do that tomorrow. Okay, I hope. But yeah, I've tried this .NET 2.0. They had, you know, just think about it. They're writing an interpreter. They had to limit it, so they, you know, they just did, you know, they realized that's the future. It's let's go to 4.0 and just get it. Yeah. Now you can debug all your .NET 2 compiled code all day long, but you can't debug the mini dumps. You're still doing WinDebug SOS. Okay.
Does this guy comment?
Right. If it's .NET 4.0 is the runtime. Yeah.
But if you're just taking dumps with 80+ and pull it right in, it's awesome. You know, because that's normally what you want. I mean, trying to look at call. Yeah, looking at call stacks with SOS is you know carpal tunnel syndrome, right? You know, it'll just kill you. So this makes it real easy. So move to .NET 4.0. You literally cut your WinDebug usage in half. Okay,
that's a pretty good return. And more importantly, it doesn't require, you know, you guys, many of you that are here at this session are probably the experts in your shop, right? You're the ones that people turn to debug everything. So guess what? If it's easier for other people to do it, now you've got more time to play solitaire. Okay? So, you know, more time to do your job, really.
Right, you know, because now you can get other people saying, hey, you know, we're kind of seeing, you know, this particular app's having a problem.
Well, now they can open up the dump and go take a look at it, right? That's the important thing. You know, is that this lowers the bar to figuring out what to do with those. Because .NET 2.0 is full WinDebug, SOS, everything else. Okay?
I have a question.
Sure.
I just try to look at the phone solving thing. Do you do the same thing? Do you find you're using WinDebug very often or not? That's an effective way.
Oh, wait. Yeah, for all the work I end up doing, all I get is a dump. It's a dump off a production box.
Production box, right. You can't get in there.
Yeah, you know, when you call up some bank and say, hey, let me terminal serve into your server. Yeah, that's a no. No. Many of the bugs I'm working on, it's production only. They can't replicate it and test to save their life.
That's nothing I help them with something replicated.
Yeah. And you know, I'm getting stuff like I was working on a nasty one in New Zealand, and you know, for whatever reason, they wouldn't pay for my flight to New Zealand. I was very upset. So was my wife. But, you know, they're not going to pay for me to go down there. So, you know, the best I'm going to get. Occasionally, you know, if it's a client app, I'll get live meeting going. And
how many dumps? You only get one dump?
Many times I only get one dump. You know, and that's all I get. And, you know, we got to make some sense out of it. Like some of the deadlocks, you know, Rick and I were working on it. If we can get, you know, two dumps, right, that's going to help because that's going to tell us, are we kind of seeing the deadlock in the same spot? And, you know, that way, you know, that's going to be, you know, better support. But, you know, the more dumps you can get, the better. Yeah, just hang up, just whatever I can get, you know. A lot of times, normally I get a dump. I'm like, hey, if you can't give me a dump, I can't see state. A lot of times I just can't. The New Zealand bug, 20 minutes. Yeah, if you're doing WPF and you don't release your event handlers, it's pretty obvious. Yeah, so that was most of them are within about a day. easily. You know, it's just because you see the patterns enough, and you know, a lot of it's just I do this all the time, so I know what to run immediately. Where a lot of folks would have to sit down with, you know, Mary Hewitt's book and learn how to, you know, and so it's just a little bit faster to have me do it, you know. Oh, yeah, yeah, I agree with you. A lot of times it's brain dead, but, you know, somebody's paying me, so I get interested really quick. You know, but, yeah, you know, most, you know, the last three bugs I've worked on, Rick and I are working on a good one. That one's taken a little bit. I think we found it right off, but we're still, you know, working on some stuff. Yeah, these two, I work with these two crazy guys here. That's why they can razz me. And know that you can't hire me. Any of you talk about hiring them, I will kill you. But most of the bugs, yeah, you know, I'm doing with an hour or two. You know, it's just, you know, just common patterns, right? What's in Gen 2, right? You know, what's the big stuff from the client and who's the references? You know, so, you know, a lot of it is get a quick look at WindyBug. And then I'm always using, I always use Watt. This other tool here, I use interchangeably. This is outside the scope of the class. MemProfiler. I want to make very clear, I do not get any money from these guys. They have not given me their product for free. I have spent my own money on this. Okay? So this is a true product testimional from somebody who's, this thing has saved their butt, my client's butts. So this, the big thing with this, you have to get the pro version. This can open up dumps. So especially if you're trying to find out who's referencing what, this tool can open it up and you can go nuts with it. And, you know, tracking down references. That's, I'm not going to do that in WindyBug, right? Now, if somebody wants to pay me to do that by the hour, I can debug a new car, right? You know, it's awesome. But, you know, I got to find the references fast. I'll use this because this can open mini dumps. However, opening up a mini dump and finding references, generally, like the last dump I opened with this, so there's folks in New Zealand, couple months or so ago, I think the open took 4 hours because they have to build up the full reference tree as they're opening it. Then once you open it, then save the dump, right? Then it's a two, then you save it to their session. Then it literally is like a 2 second open, but you have to do that initial analysis of the dump.
So I went, kind of let it run overnight, came back in and pretty much found out that it was an event handle
and showed them exactly what it was leaking in, you know, cause it showed the references.
So I also use the Redgate tools,
the Redgate bundle, but I will be honest, Redgate gave me that free. So, you know, that was very nice of them.
How does that compare to Ant?
I use them interchangeably. Just
whatever the client has, you know, but, you know, somebody at Redgate liked my book and they said, hey, you want our tools? And I'm like, yeah, cool, dude. Awesome. You know, so, you know, they just gave me the tools, you know, because I bumped into those guys before. So I use them interchangeably. We, whatever the client has, you know, I'll use the different tools to see. I'll use both tools at the same time, you know, to kind of see, you know, because one, you know, the Ant tool kind of does some interesting display, especially your references. It's a little bit easier to kind of see that. So, you know, depending on what I'm looking for, you know, each tool has its power. You know,
but you know, tools are dirt cheap, right? I sat one of the best plane flights I ever had, was I got to sit next to, the chief personnel officer, the
human resources director, you know, for a Fortune 50 company. And I got to ask all of those questions you always wanted to ask HR people. Like, how do I get my boss to buy things?
Okay. And this guy had a very, very
good comeback. He said,
oh, it's real simple.
Your cost to the company is three times your salary.
Overhead, you know, lights, you know, that's how much you cost company, health insurance, all of that. So basically,
whatever you try to justify buying a tool, take your hourly rate, take your daily rate, multiply it
by three. That's how much you cost. All of a sudden you find out real quick, it's really expensive to have you sitting there screwing around. And you got a tool for $300 that's going to show you the references in 20 minutes.
Jeez.
That's cheap. Dirt cheap. So there's the
justification, except for Daddy Rabbit, right?
I
have creamed Lewis about this, but, you know, that's how you can, you know, start justifying these costs. Okay? So, you know, give it a shot, you know.
And anyway, I'm the approving authority. Just buy it. JetBrains tool is pretty good. I haven't used the JetBrains tool as much, you know, but you know, I use this and I use the Redgate tool. Any tool you can get your hands on. But the last thing, when it comes to tools, right, don't be learning the tool and trying to debug your problem at the same time. That will take you exponentially longer. Okay? Sit down, make sure you practice with these tools before you deal with it. Okay? But I know, sorry about that, we kind of went off topic a little bit, but that's kind of some of the cool stuff that we do. So, you know, just go grab those dumps, load it up into Visual Studio. Seeing your dump directly in Visual Studio is so simple, right? And we can look at the state of the app. We can see this is exactly where we were in the previous dump. So, you know, we get a one-to-one mapping. So it's very, very nice, very brain dead. Okay? I'll talk about IntelliTrace. IntelliTrace rocks, right? This is the most exciting thing that's happened to debugging on the Windows platform since I started developing for Windows 3.0. Okay? So, you know, when I first saw this, I went, oh my God, what is IntelliTrace in a nutshell? It's basically a video of your application. That's basically what it is. They record everything that's going on in your app at a kind of, not at the lowest level, but kind of at the highest level. So, you know, let's set this up. Now, what I'm finding, I think I mentioned this earlier, I'm finding I'm debugging about 25% faster with this. Why? Because I'm not running stuff in the debugger all the time. What do? I look at the log. Okay? So let's go. Now, some caveats. Okay? This is the key differentiator with Visual Studio 2010 Ultimate and Visual Studio 2010 Premium. Okay? Everyone in this room needs to be using Ultimate so they can use IntelliTrace. Right now, it only works with the x86 debugger, but like I said earlier, if you use a Microsoft Test Manager, 64-bit works with your testers, and they can give you the logs. Right? You know, the testing, the MTM, Microsoft Test Manager, is very, very cool stuff in DevTen because they went after the no repro problem. Right? We've all been there. The tester says, I got this bug over here. The developer says, I can't repro it. They mark it as no repro. Right? The tester says, but I'm getting it all the time. The developer says, not on my machine. Right? You know? And the tester's over there just about to, their head's about to explode because they're getting it, but the developer won't walk over and look at the tester's machine. So the idea is that the testers run their stuff from MTM these days. What happens? It records everything that goes on into an IntelliTrace log. Then when the tester says, here's the problem I'm seeing, what's part of that bug report? The IntelliTrace log. Right? So they see everything that went on. So, so this is pretty cool. So let's get this cracking. Let's shut down our debugging. Is that? Yeah. Oops, that was the wrong one. I just shut down our dump. Sorry. All right, I shut down our process for doing debug. Closed solution. So, project solution. Let's open up CS Breakpoint. So one thing. Ooh, I forgot to do it. This does require x86. Okay. Oh, Itanium. Any of you doing Itanium? Not anymore. And they finally killed it. They announced it in a blog. What most people call the Itanium, the Itanic. But anyway. what's that? There was only three companies that did Itanium stuff, right? Intel, obviously. Microsoft, because they were being nice to Intel, and the Japanese railroad system is all completely run off Itanium. And that was the big customer for this stuff. So you do have to have an x86 binary. But, you know, here's what's cool about this, is that, I think I got some breakpoints set here. Let's
set one.
So we'll go ahead and let this rip. And what happens when I run under the debugger here, okay, is that at the same time I'm running, it's collecting an IntelliTrace log, right? So I've got, you know, the video of my application. And let's go, big loop here, we'll just stop there. But, you know, I've got my log that shows me what I've done. But I forgot to mention something, I apologize. When you set up IntelliTrace, let me give you, I talked already about VS Host. There's two ways you can run IntelliTrace here. First is to collect events only. The other is to collect events and call information. Let me make this really simple. If you don't do events and call information, you're not getting any benefit out of IntelliTrace. You know, events are things, you know, like events firing and stuff like that. You need the call stack in order to see what's going on. This also, it's going to slow down your app. Who cares how slow it runs under the debugger? Because you want that video so you can walk through your app to see what it was doing. Okay? So you can see execution. You can see what's going on. The other thing you're going to want to do is turn on the IntelliTrace events, turn them all on. I'm dead serious. Just turn them all on because nothing is worse than somebody giving you an IntelliTrace run and they forgot to turn on the one event that you needed. Okay? Just
turn them all on. Just get it over with, right? Turn them all on. That way you have them. Honestly, I honestly don't even notice any slowdown. This is what I've got on all my machines, and I don't notice any difference by having everything turned on, right? I'm sure if I sat there with a stopwatch, maybe I would, but I really don't care. I want the log so I can refer back to it, okay? And so this is incredibly important that you do this. And so I've got everything turned on there, and this is integrated right in the debugger, right? So, you know, I can single step through here, but it's like, well, wait a minute, I want to go back, and you can see over here in the log, okay? You know, it shows me my breakpoints. It shows me gestures. And what are these gestures, right? These gestures are telling you when things happen, like an event happened, like a button click, like console.writeline, like a trace. You know, you've got the whole list of events, and if you feel hardcore, you can go add your own. Okay? It's kind of undocumented, but you can go look at the call stack window. How did we end up here? What did the locals look like, right? And it records most of the state of the app. So this is literally a video of your application, okay? And, I mean, it's so amazing to just sit here and go, kind of wander through, right? There's my calls view, everything like that. You know, there's the calls that I'm looking at. I can default to the event view. We can switch the calls. Then we can see, you know, where we were, what we were executing. And then at any time I want to, go back to live mode. But it's like, oh, I'm backwards. Can I step backwards? Control-Shift-F11.
I'm telling you guys, if you're not using IntelliTrace, you're screwed. Okay? If you're paid by the hour, awesome. You know, it's going to take you forever. But, I mean, it is so awesome to just sit. I literally just sit there and go backwards and forward as I'm reading the code. Right? What did this do? Okay? Now, let me go F11 forward again. Yeah, okay, okay. Oh, no. Control-Shift-F11.
Right? I literally just play forwards and backwards. Right? How did I get in here? Okay, if I pump different data in, and it, what I'm finding myself doing is I'm using the debugger less because it's forcing me to think about the code more, right? Because I'm looking at this video going, oh, okay, wait a minute. You know, I'm looking at, you know, as I play back and forth, wait a minute, I really need to add a condition here. So I just stop debugging, fix my code, and continue on, right? So it's very interactive scenario. It's pretty cool. So, you know, the fact we can go look at all our states, you know, as we're debugging through the app is just awesome. You know, the one thing they didn't do, though, and this is going to show up very soon, is I want it to run backwards to breakpoints.
Okay, that would be cool,
right? They just didn't have time to get that in when I was talking with the team.
But one thing they do, they also have a cool thing here. It's kind of hidden.
They want to have a better UI on this, but here's what you have. Is that you can search, I right click and say search for this line in IntelliTrace. This will kind of get you there, right? You know, it's kind of almost like running backwards. So search for this line in IntelliTrace, that'll bring up this here. That'll show you all the lines that have been recorded at that location, okay? And so this way, then you can roll back to it, and, you know, I've only got one there, but, you know, if you've got something big and recursive, that way you can start looking at the different runs because they show,
then you can just move through the individual runs. In fact, let me continue to step through here.
That'll give us some more run, okay?
And so let me go search for this run in the log, find an IntelliTrace. Now I've got three hits. Then what I can do here is just move
between the three. So it's almost like going back to the breakpoint. So it's very, very convenient. Here's the final thing about IntelliTrace. This works great with .NET 2.0 apps.
You don't have to go to .NET 4 to get this.
Awesomeness, right? You guys can start using this. You will have to have an x86 compile.
Okay, that's, you know, they just didn't have a chance to get the full stuff in there.
Will this work with the web application?
Absolutely, doesn't care. Doesn't care. And, you know, that's what's cool about this is it doesn't matter what type of .NET development you're doing. They do the right thing. Web apps, everything else. Okay, so you get,
the video of your application that you can play forwards and backwards really is going to make a big difference. Because really, what is debugging? When you stop in the debugger, what are you looking at? Here's my state. How did I get here? Well, I can see the call stack. But that call stack did 5 million other things. Well, now you can see the 5 million other things, right? Everybody in this room has to have IntelliTrace. I mean, I was so excited about this when I first heard about it.
What support does it give you with Threads?
Okay. What support does it give you with Threads? You have full thread support because if you've got multiple threads, they have, the events. You can move between threads. You know? So you can say, I just want to focus on this one thread. You know, I mean, they handle all of this. You know, and it's you know, the first time you go backwards, it's kind of like, holy crap, how come we haven't had this for the last 25 years? You know, it just really is something that, you know, just makes total intuitive sense to have. Okay? So you've got full thread support and everything else.
I don't know. I don't know what the cost. No, no. I don't know what the costs are. Is any Microsoft guys here that can talk about costs? yeah, there's yeah, it's not free. but you know, there's some. I don't know. I don't, you know. But that, you know, you need to have full TFS and all of that installed to take advantage of that. So you're into that.
It's really big
shots. Yeah, small shots. Yeah, we use TFS and demo.
Yeah.
If you want the full thing, you got to do full TFS. Yeah, they do have the basic, right? That's a replacement for source data. No, it's not that bad. Yeah. So, you know, check. You know, there's, you know, list price, yes, but, you know, Microsoft's going to cut the deals. You know, I'm sure everybody in here has got some Microsoft sales guy that's got a deal.
I mentioned the test manager recently in a user group, and they said, isn't that like Windows 7 piece?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this goes way beyond that, because this is hooked into the version control. It's hooked into the bug tracking system, MTM. You know, the problem report solution thing,
theoretically, that's just recording the video of what's going on the screen.
That's not the video of your app. That's not in conjunction with what tests you told it to run, everything else. So MTM is way
bigger.
Okay. The problem report
thing is literally just a screen capture. You know, it just happens to be a movie. Okay, so this goes way beyond that.
How does our QA team take a release mode 2.0.NET app and give us one?
If they run the test through the Microsoft Test Manager, that's how they get it.
Right, and that's one of the collection options for this.
As they're running a test, you know, and you can have automated tests, you know, coded UI, everything else can be done .NET 2.0. That's one of the collection options. You say, go collect this information when I get to run. Okay? Just make sure you crank the knob up to 11. Okay? Because you want all of the information in these logs. Trust me. Don't skip anything. Right? Just throw bigger hardware at it if you think there's a performance bar. I honestly can't tell with all the full stuff on the difference between with debugging 64-bit and debugging with the, if I did this whole demo with x86, you'd never know it. Okay, the performance difference is not that big of a deal. Okay? So cool. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah, right.
For people that are considering upgrading, I asked the Visual Studio PM when I saw him if, because we were looking at doing it for a client, that of course this will, you can still do 2.0, 3.5 and all that here. The problem is the project files are not compatible.
Right.
You do have to update all your solution files, project files, so
yep.
We weren't able to switch.
Yeah, but that's the only thing you have to update. You know, it's still using the exact same compiler. And so, you know, yes,
Microsoft knows this is a pain in the butt, so you can't have just the one guy using Dev10.
Yeah.
It's kind of, realize, you know, you're going to have to play some games with backups and things like that. So, you know, that's what we've seen
some clients do, is that they just have one or two of the top folks working with the tools. But to, yeah, they run, I've got Visual Studio 2008 on this machine. Okay. They run side by side just great. But, you know, the project files and solution files are different. Okay, but you're still using the exact same compiler, right? That's the thing that's different. But it's definitely worth taking a look at. So IntelliTrace is just incredible. Hope I convinced you. Seeing a video of your application makes it awesome. Like I said earlier, I'm finding it best. My opinion is to turn off the VS host. So there's a one-to-one mapping. Okay, but let me show you kind of one of the problems here. So we'll let this go and oops, where were we? F5. Here's my app. We'll, you know, click some of these other buttons. Oh, I had some breakpoints there. Okay. But here's my run. And then I shut down. Okay. Oh, my God. Where the hell did it go? Okay. And this is a big problem. Because I want to go, you know, because when do you really want to look at the run? When it ends. Okay. And where is that run? It disappeared into the ether. Unless you use my macro. So I wrote this macro called the IntelliTrace Helper. It does the work because there's a known spot where these are stored. You double click this and it grinds through and it runs and it opens up the very last trace log you were running.
Okay.
And this opens it up, and then, you know, it shows you the thread, so we can double-click on the thread. That will
open up the log. There you go. Okay. So use my macro to go open up the last run. Okay. And I, the very first time I ran this on the pre-alpha, I was like, what the hell are you people thinking? Right? You know, because, you know, where did this log go? Because everybody wants to look at it. So I gave, I wrote my macro, and they went, wow, that's a brilliant solution. Like, no, it's a macro. Okay. I did that in desperation. So you have my macro. That will open up the last run that you executed. So then you can look at it after the fact. Okay. And does all the right stuff. So you're in good shape. So
easy enough, simple to do. And knock yourselves out with that. Just double click on the thread, start debugging.
Now, the last thing we'll talk about here is remote debugging. Okay. I have pretty good news about remote debugging. It does work pretty well. I have some bad news for some of you. To do remote debugging, both machines have to be on the same domain, or it has to be a two-way trust. How many of you have test domains that are on a different domain than your test machine? Sorry. You're going to get to install Visual Studio on the test machine and remote desktop. Okay. Why do we have this limitation?
Because remote debugging uses DCOM.
I just gave some people a shudder. It uses DCOM, and so we're kind of stuck with DCOM security. And that means two-way trust or got to be on the same domain. If you have that scenario, remote debugging is a dream. Okay? But if your test lab is in a different domain,
you can wait for Dev 11.
Because that's when it's going to be fixed. So it's kind of frustrating, kind of nasty, but, you know, it's actually, if you meet the requirements, it's pretty brain dead. So let's get, you know, I'm going to, you know, you got the first time you run this, you have two machines, right? What's called the remote machine, that's where your application is running. Then you have the local machine, that's where Visual Studio is running. Okay, there's the two machines you've got. So this directory here needs to get over to the remote machine, whether you X copy it, whether you map the drive, share it and map the drive, who cares? This directory has to run. On the remote machine, what you're going to do to set it up, log in with the same account on both machines. Just make it simple. First thing you're going to do is you're going to run msvsmon, and it's going to ask you, hey, do you need to set up the firewall? You say yes. Yes again. Just do the local network. Now we're set. And the important thing here, this machine's ready to be connected to, is the server name. Okay? So what this – oh, shoot, I hit the magnifier. Sorry. Was that thing? The folks on live meeting can't see that, but want to show this. So what we see is that it's logged in user at machine name. Okay, that's the important thing. But with DCOM, you can do all sorts of stuff with security and say who can do it, blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of nice, right? So you can narrow it down. So that's the important thing. Now let's switch over to the local machine. That's where Visual Studio is running. Okay? And let me shut down this IntelliTrace log here. Okay? And I'm going to go test this, so I'm going to go debug, attach to process, and what I'm going to do here is in the qualifier name, type in user account at machine name that MSVSmon told me. Then you click refresh, if you see stuff, you're good. That's it, okay? If you see any message boxes, it's bad, it's pretty good. You know, it used to be, how many of you tried the old remote debugging, where any error message was access denied? And that's all they told you, right? Now they're a lot better about telling you, you know, exactly what happened. But to prove to you that we're actually remote debugging, let's go over to the remote machine.
I connected. I'm actually ready to do remote debugging on this machine. Okay? You know, we can do that. So, you know, you do that first setup, make you log into both machines,
you're good to go now, right? Everything's done. The firewall is set. The real magic, okay, is there's remote machine, local machine setup. Requiring you to log in to use MSVSmon. Most of you are working on server apps, right? This is kind of nuts. So you're going to run MSVSmon as a service. Okay? And through RDBG setup with the DBD.
Oh, by the way, the remote debugging tools are on the Visual Studio DBD in the remote debugging directory. Okay? So you can run RDBG Wiz. That will walk you through setting up three steps, MSVSmon running as a service, which account.
The big thing here is that any accounts that you connect to the remote machine with must be in the local administrator group.
Because if they're not in the local administrator group,
guess what? It's called access denied. Okay? So, you know, put stars around that, you know.
You your account making the connection has to be an admin on that local machine. Okay? And that's what everybody forgets to do.
Fortunately, the error message is pretty good now. It's access denied, you're not an admin, so it's pretty obvious what you forgot to do. Okay? So then you connect and you're debugging all day long. You can also start processes on another machine, right? So you have to be logged in. MSVSmon has to be running. You have to be logged in on the same account on both machines, and MSVSmon has to be running in that account.
You can't be running as a service for this because you're going to tell MSVSmon over there to call create process for you. Okay?
So what you can do is you can set up MSVSmon here. Over here in the solution, in the properties, configuration properties, properties, let's open this up. What you're going to do is go to debug. Your best bet, keep everything in the same drive and directory on both machines. That way there is no thinking involved.
Like a manager can handle that, right? The minute you get, you know, different drives and directories, you know, no manager can handle it. So leave it
the same drive and directory on both machines. What do you specify here? You just got to specify the remote machine name.
And what that will do,
that will pass over, assuming it's the same drive and directory on both machines, that will tell MSVSmon on the remote machine, go start that process out of that directory. Okay? So, what happens if you can't? Because you're building on the G drive on the local machine, but you don't
have a G drive on the remote machine. Well,
you know, whatever. You could use subs. Oh, wow, there's an old school command. Brought back memories. Or you can map a drive, you know, maybe fake it out, maybe you can get it. Worst case scenario, what you're going to do, you're going to do start external program. And what you're going to type in this box is the full path to drive and directory where that program was on the other machine.
That string is what's passed over to MSVSmon, and that's what MSVSmon calls create process on.
Okay? So that's how you can work around that.
Now, the last thing I want to mention here with remote debugging, actually two things.
First, remember I talked about, you know, file open project solution, then opening up the EXE, right? You know, which is pretty cool stuff. So let's close that solution. Let's do that. Open project solution because the setup is slightly different. So let's go to debug. Go to animated algorithm again. Because we're opening up the EXE, what are we going to do? Okay. The difference here, you're going to set machine name, and you're going to set the connection, this is slightly different, to remote with Windows authentication. That's it. Okay? And you're going to set the remote machine name. What is this going to do? That's going to start the process by default. But what if you set this attach to yes? What is that going to do? Test the process on the other machine. MSVSmon has to be running on the other machine. That way you can get it set up to attach easily. Okay? In fact, it took me longer to talk about this than it is for you to go back to the office and set this up. Seriously, it's you know, the remote debugging has gotten quite a bit better, right? Some of you remember spending days trying to get it to work. Now, the last bit of confusion is where do the PDB files go? It's kind of stupid, but native PDBs are loaded where Visual Studio is running. .NET PDBs are loaded over where MSVSmon is running. So for your private builds, keep everything in the same drive and directory. You don't have to think about it anymore. The right thing happens. But what about public build stuff, stuff off a build server, for example? What you're going to have to do to get the public.NET stuff you might need to do is you're going to have to set up the symbol path because that will set up and load off your symbol server that you've set up on at your company. Okay? Then that will get the public stuff out of that symbol server on the remote machine. You've already got that set up for Visual Studio, so that'll pull that out. Okay? One last thing, access denied. This is the one access denied that doesn't make any sense. If you're debugging where the remote machine is a work or only machine, and it's not on the domain, you're going to get an access denied every single time. Not real clear why, but what's happened is that the default for network access sharing and security model is set to guest. DCOM can't work over that. So you got to set it to classic. That will now you can debug to work group only machines.
Whew, you survived.
Oh my God. Oh my God. What are you guys going to do if you have any questions between now and the end of time? Email me. I just sit at home pressing F9 in Outlook.
That's all I do.
Where's the question? So I'll stick around if anybody's got any questions.